Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We begin this edition with two important event announcements. The fourth memorial program in the Evelyn Abdallah Menkoni Memorial Cultural Series will take place this year on Tuesday, April 24, 2008, in the Rab Lecture Hall at the Boston Public Library. The program, entitled Remembrance, Images, and Musical Resonance, will focus this year on the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba and the 93rd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. The program will feature an exposition of the Palestinian narrative, a discussion on Muslim women and the veil, and musical entertainment featuring the qanun, the traditional stringed instrument of Arabic music. The event is made possible by the kind support of the William G. Abdallah Library, the American Arab Media Foundation, Tawassul, and members of the Abdallah Menkoni family, as well as by the voluntary contributions of the program committee members. Please mark your calendars for this iconic cultural event, Tuesday, April 24th, in the Rab Lecture Hall at the Boston Public Library. Reception starts at 5:30 p.m. The program starts at 6:30 p.m. On Wednesday, April 30th, a benefit concert will be held for the children of Gaza from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul, located at 138 Tremont Street in Boston, across from the Park Street T station. The event will feature Gaza poet Dima Faisa, the Layali Arabic Music Ensemble, Aboud Agha, lead vocalist of the Boston-based Shark Ensemble, Grammy Award-winning blues pianist David Maxwell, jazz pianist and singer Ellen Cantaro, and former political prisoner in Chile, songwriter and poet Sergio Reyes. There will also be a silent auction of Palestinian handicrafts and slides by Boston photographer Skip Scheel. Please mark your calendars for this very important event, Wednesday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul, located at 138 Tremont Street in Boston, across the street from the Park Street T station. Bring your friends, stand in solidarity with the people of Palestine who have to live under Israel's savage military occupation, and help the children of Gaza. It is Sunday, April 13th, 2008. Last Wednesday, April 9th, marked the 60th anniversary of the massacre of the residents of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin, a 700-year-old village whose inhabitants were known to have been living peacefully with their Jewish neighbors. At 3 a.m. in the morning of April 9th, 1948, a month before Israel declared itself a state, between 130 and 150 Palestinian residents, all women, children, and elderly men over 60, were forced out of their homes at gunpoint, paraded down the streets of Jaffa, and systematically executed. Survivors were paraded down the streets of Jerusalem with loudspeaker warnings to other Palestinians that the same fate would await them if they stayed in their homes. In her address at Annapolis on November 27, 2007, Israeli Vice Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs Tzipi Livni said, among other things, quote, "Establish your own state, rejoice in its establishment, and we will rejoice with you, since for us the establishment of the Palestinian state is not our Nakba or disaster, provided that upon its establishment the word Nakba be deleted from the Arabic lexicon in referring to Israel." To understand why it is impossible simply to dismiss that remark as merely insensitive or even insulting, suppose a German foreign minister had addressed Jews on the eve of the partition of Palestine in 1947 and said, quote, "Establish your own state, rejoice in its establishment, and we will rejoice with you, since for us the establishment of the Jewish state is not our Holocaust or disaster, provided that upon its establishment the word Holocaust be deleted from the Jewish lexicon in referring to Germany." The Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, and refers to the forced eviction, slaughter and expulsion of the 750,000 Palestinians, or more than half the population of Palestinians from their homes to make way for the creation of the State of Israel, is every bit as much of an abomination to Palestinians as the Holocaust is to Jews. Virtually everyone in the world knows the history of the Holocaust in Germany. Very few know the history of the Nakba, which has been purposely hidden from public awareness in the West and virtually banned from public education venues. Today we have the privilege of continuing our discussion of the recent history of Palestine and the Nakba and what it means to Palestinians with the distinguished Palestinian physician and scholar Dr. Ghada Karmi, research fellow and lecturer at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom, and world-renowned author and commentator on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Dr. Karmi was in Boston last week giving talks about her recently published book, Married to Another Man, Israel's Dilemma in Palestine, published by the Pluto Press in 2007. We highly recommend that book to anyone who wishes to understand the roots of the conflict and the ensuing tragedy which continues to unfold before our eyes. Dr. Karmi's other book, In Search of Fatima, A Palestinian Story, which we also highly recommend, is a powerful account of her personal experience of being torn out of her home in Jerusalem and her life in exile. Two other books, which Dr. Karmi edited with essays by the late Edward Said and other notable personalities, are The Palestinian Exodus and Jerusalem Today, What Future for the Peace Process. The following is a pre-recorded interview I had the privilege of conducting with Dr. Karmi last Friday before she left early this morning to continue on her tour of speaking engagements.
Let me just jump in here quickly and say that you are listening to WZBC Newton.
Good morning, Dr. Ghada Karmi. Thank you for being our guest today on This Week in Palestine.
Good morning.
Your book, Married to Another Man, Israel's Dilemma in Palestine, is a very important book, not only because of the wealth of thoroughly documented history it provides, but, more importantly in my view, because of the trenchant insights you give into the myths Israelis, and indeed most Jews in the diaspora, cling to justify their actions and support for Israel, and the largely imperial interests of the Western powers that have guided their support for Israel. Your book also brings to the fore, for the first time, the cost of Israel to the Palestinians and Arabs, a cost largely hidden and ignored by the West. I have to admit that I tried reading your book from cover to cover, but found myself returning again and again to the first three chapters. Let me begin by asking you how you came to the catchy title, Married to Another Man.
Well, this actually refers to a story that took place at the end of the 19th century, when the Zionist movement had started in Europe. The Zionists decided in 1897 that the only way to solve the Jewish problem of persecution in Europe, was for them to establish a state for Jews only. And they decided that that Jewish state, should be in a country called Palestine. Now, they didn't know much about it. They didn't know much about the Middle East, in fact, in general. So they sent a couple of rabbis whom they asked to let them know what this country, Palestine, was like, and was it the right place for the Jewish state or what. So the rabbis went, they had a look, and they sent back the following message to the Zionist headquarters in Vienna. They said, the bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man. Now, of course, what they meant was, yes, indeed, the land was lovely and very suitable for the Jewish state, but unfortunately, it was already inhabited by another people. And I wanted very much to use that title because, to my mind, it sums up the whole problem. The title tells the whole story, really. Because the land was full of other people, that is, the other man, it really was going to cause a lot of problems for the Zionist movement to establish a state for Jews only in a land full of non-Jews. And I'm afraid the conflict, the tragic conflict which we've seen for the 60 years that have passed since that state was established, are exactly, precisely the consequence of trying to create a state in someone else's country, putting your own people in there, and getting rid of the indigenous inhabitants, that is, the Palestinians.
Yes, so goes myth number one. A land without people for a people without land.
Exactly, exactly. The most pernicious myth. This is the most pernicious lie that the Zionists came up with and seemed to persuade a lot of their followers, who also hadn't been to the Middle East, had no idea, and had this picture of this kind of desert with nobody in it. So, you know, nobody was gonna be worried if you brought in a load of European Jews into that place. And it's a complete lie, of course. Complete lie.
The Nakba struck you and your family directly. In your earlier book, In Search of Fatima, A Palestinian Story, you tell the story of how you were forced to leave your home in Jerusalem in a hurry for fear of your life at the tender age of 9 in April of 1948, a month before Israel declared itself a state. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, it's very painful, really. I was eight, in fact. And funnily enough, I mean, the only reason I say that is actually it makes a difference when you're that young. Mm. 1 year makes a difference. Mm. Yes, it was spring, rather like now, here in this country. It was April, and it was cold. Jerusalem gets cold in the winter and the spring. And of course, as a child, I didn't understand why we had to leave our home. I didn't understand what was going on. I knew that my parents were scared. I knew that there was something terribly wrong with our lives because I wasn't going to school anymore. We couldn't go out and play anymore because of the fear that we might be shot at by Jewish militiamen and snipers. And everybody was scared. That's what I chiefly remember. And then I got scared because I didn't want to leave my home. I had a dog, which I loved dearly, dearly. And we couldn't take him with us. And for me, you know, as a child, those things were the things that stand out. Having to leave my home, having to leave the dog that was our pet, having to leave Fatima. Fatima of the title, who was a village woman who used to look after us, used to help my mother clean the house, and whom I loved dearly. And I suddenly realized we had to leave all these things and people and the life I knew, we had to leave it behind. It was absolutely shattering. It was indescribably terrible for me. But, you know, we were comforted at the time. My parents said it won't be long. It's just, you know, for a short while, and, you know, it's a bit dangerous now, and don't worry. And I remember being desperately worried about the dog, and Fatima saying, don't worry, I'll look after him till you're back. We thought we'd be away for a couple of weeks. What a tragic, pathetic belief. Of course, we were never allowed back. You know, the Israelis, who having got their state, the last thing they wanted was letting people like us come home again. And we were never allowed to return.
Yeah, and you left your childhood behind.
Yes.
Must have been a very frightening experience. April 11th also happens to be the date of the massacre of the residents of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin.
Let me correct you. It was actually April the 9th. You're very close, but it was April the 9th.
April the 9th, yes.
That's right.
Well, yes. Did you not leave April 9th?
That's right. Not April 9th. We left a day later.
A day later?
Yes.
So you already knew about the massacre at Deir Yassin?
Yes. It took a little while to find out, you know, because there were no the kind of communications we have today. But people were coming along telling us that something terrible had happened. There were whispers that some awful massacre had taken place. And of course, Deir Yassin was a village in to the west of Jerusalem. It wasn't very far from where we lived. And the Jewish forces entered that little village, which was completely peaceful. And they shot dead men, women, and children. They killed about 200 in cold blood. And then they got the survivors, put them on trucks, and paraded them through the streets of Jerusalem, saying, it's your turn next. So it was really very, very scary, terribly scary. That was the thing that propelled my parents to leave as quickly as possible. Now, I say the next day, I'm not really sure. Nobody's quite sure exactly the date we left, but it was like within a couple of days of that massacre, and that was the immediate cause why we really had to leave. Very, very effective for the Zionists.
Yes, they had followed that that method by massacring people in other villages and then threatening everybody else with the same end if they stayed in their homes. What has it felt like to live all these years in exile from your country and away from your roots?
Well, it depends at which stage we're talking. As a child, with the immediate memories of having been wrenched from everything I knew and loved, it was really awful, really awful. We went to Damascus first because my grandparents lived in Damascus, so there was a point of refuge for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we went there first, and we were there for about a year and a half. And that was one of the worst times in my life. I hated it in Damascus. I couldn't get used to the fact that I had lost my home. I didn't know. I still didn't know exactly why we had to be there, and I didn't. It was alien to me. It was different. Everything was different there.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's the other myth that the Zionists peddle all the time, which is that there are 22 Arab states. So why don't the Arabs, the Palestinians, just go and live there? You know, there's only one Jewish state. You know, they seem not to understand that we differ. We differ. We're not the same. We're not exactly the same. So for me to go to Damascus, which was quite close to Palestine, was not the same as being in Jerusalem. It really wasn't.
Of course not. It's just like saying Europeans are Europeans without recognizing the difference between Italians and the French and the Dutch.
Yes, something sort of similar, although obviously in the Arab world we speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about as far as it goes, quite honestly. Anyway, that was awful. And then the next horror was that we left, having barely begun to get used to Damascus, we left for London. Because my father, who was looking for work desperately, you know, the Palestinians had no money. They were left their homes under the most awful circumstances. So they didn't have any means of survival. They had to get jobs where they could. My father got a job in London for the BBC. And we were wrenched again from our grandparents and ended up in London.
Israel was admitted into the United Nations on condition that it accept the right to return of the Palestinian refugees, as embodied in the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194 of December of 48. But Israel never did accept that right, propagating instead the myth that the refugee problem arose as the result of the war of 1948, when, according to Israel, Arab armies invaded the state of Israel and Palestinians voluntarily fled the moment the war started, in response to calls by Arab leaders to make way for the invading armies. Now, that myth was debunked many times over.
Mm-hmm.
It was shown by many historians that roughly half, or perhaps a little less than half, the refugees were expelled before Israel was created a state, before of May 14th of 1948. And in fact, you are living proof of the fact that that myth is a lie. Dr. Karmi, why do Jews support Israel? What is the hold of Zionism on Jews?
Well, that's a very important question, I think, and one I did go into in my book, as you said in your introduction. I was extremely fascinated by something I came to understand when growing up in a very Jewish area of London, actually. I got to know an awful lot of Western Jews, the very people who had been behind the Zionist movement. And the thing that came across to me was their... don't know how to put it, the almost kind of knee-jerk support, almost desperate support for the Jewish state, even if not the actual Jewish state, but the idea of the Jewish state, that there had to be this thing called a Jewish state. Now, it was a view amongst Arabs, who I think didn't understand the issue, that the Zionist movement was just simply a settler colonialist movement. People came, told a pack of lies, took over our country, threw us out, and what we had to do is to get strong enough to throw them out, and then that would be the end of the story. Now, although that's true, yes, indeed, it was perfectly true, this is a settler colonialist movement, but what most Arabs didn't understand was the degree of devotion of Jews who are not living in the Jewish state, Jews outside, to the idea of the Jewish state. Now, I came to understand that this was quite psychological, and it was in part due to the feeling of fear, of insecurity, due to the history of persecution of Jews in Europe, the idea that they could feel safe just with the idea of a Jewish state, that you know, if something ever happened, then they could all immigrate to Israel, and there they'd feel safe. But it was also something else. It was also something to do with their identity. It was bound up with their feeling of being Jews, which was linked to a series of historical, religious, mythological notions that were neatly tied with the land of Palestine, which they called Israel, by the Zionists. So, in other words, the Zionist movement was extremely effective in not only taking another people's country, but in introducing to Jews outside the state the idea that they couldn't be full Jews or proper Jews unless they felt identified with the state of Israel. Now, once I began to understand that, I realized the depth of the problem we are facing. That in fighting for our rights as Palestinians who had been expelled from our homeland, we would be coming up not just against a wall of military strength. After all, Israel is the most powerful army in the region and the fourth most powerful army in the world. So we weren't going to be just coming across the might of the Israeli army, but against the power of this psychological mythological, part fantasy association with Israel on the part of so many Jews who live in the United States and who live in Europe. You know, and it's very hard that. We are a small people. Good God, how can we fight, this kind of blind devotion? What can I say? It's like trying to split up a couple where they're madly in love. It's very difficult to do.
Yes, and one myth that you treat in your book, the myth that was propagated by the Zionist leaders to bolster the claim that Jews have a valid and exclusive historical claim to the land of Palestine, is that Jews were historically a nation in exile, and that Jews everywhere have a common ancestry with Middle Eastern Jews. That myth inspired numerous investigations into the genetic signatures of Jews. Mm. What did those investigations show?
Yeah, well, as you point out so well, the most enduring lie is the lie that there is an independent, recognizable Jewish nation. And indeed, as you have said, that Jewish nation has a particular history, and it leaves its homeland in Palestine in remote times, in ancient times, and is dispersed all over the world. And despite that dispersal, and despite the passage of centuries and centuries, apparently these people are still part of the same original people, and they all come from my country, Palestine. Yeah. Now, the geneticists, who were desperate to establish some kind of scientific backing backing for this idiotic idea, because let's face it, it's a completely idiotic idea. There is no such thing in history that a people, even if they genuinely came from that part of the world, then leave it, and 2,000 years or more later, all say, oh, we're the same people. It's completely idiotic. Nevertheless, the Zionists desperately needed some kind of respectable scientific backing for this stuff. So they engaged, or there were numerous geneticists started working on trying to find genetic associations between people living in Poland and people in the Middle East.
A so-called Jewish gene.
A Jewish gene, which would prove that these really are part of the same gene pool, if therefore the same people. Now, it wouldn't surprise anybody listening to this to know that, of course, they were unable to do that. What they did, in fact, show was that Polish Jews were closer to non-Polish Jews than they were to Arabs. And Arab Jews, that is, Moroccan Jews or Yemenite Jews, were closer to non-Jewish Arabs than they were to a Jew from Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Of course, there was no comfort for them in the genetics argument, and it was a waste of time and money. And furthermore, there was a certain amount of bad science going on, because from time to time you'd get a paper with some excited conclusion saying, we've discovered this gene between the priestly class, the Cohens. Which proves that the Cohens, all over the world, wherever they may reside, all are related to each other. But of course, when this was subjected to proper analysis, it was found to be faulty. The science behind it was faulty. And, this desperate hunt, I'm glad to say, in recent times, seems to have subsided. They've realized, do it.
There is, I believe, a study which was published in the in 2000, in the issue in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which found that Jewish men shared a set of common genetic signatures with non-Jews from the Middle East, including Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. So that study puts the lie to the exclusivist claim of Zionism, because if Zionism bases its historical claim to Palestine on the genetic signatures of Jews, then Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese share equally in that claim.
Exactly.
And for Zionists, of course, that idea has to be squelched at all costs,
mm-hmm.
because the exclusivist myth cannot live on.
No. No.
Why does the West support Israel?
Well, that again, you see, is a complex question, which I went into. The support for Israel in the West is many-faceted. It's got many sides to it. It's not a simple one. And you have to consider various things. Well, let's go for just some very simple ones. Well, there is the question of interests. Now, the Western world has considerable interest in the area of the Middle East. The area of the Middle East is strategically important. Palestine was strategically important because it was, for the British, for example, after the First World War, it was a place that if you could control it, you would be very close to the Suez Canal, and you'd be very close to the routes to the Indian Ocean. But of course, the Arab region is also full of oil, and that is of extreme importance to the Western world. Now, one of the ideas, therefore, in supporting Israel along these lines was that if you, that is the West, have a friendly, very friendly state, which is devoted to you because you've helped it to come into being and you've helped to maintain it and make it strong and you give it money all the time, well then, the idea is that that state will become your local agent. It will do things that suit you, and it will be able to destroy stop any movement on the part of Arabs to try and control their own oil or to set terms unfavorable to the West, etc. That's the idea. That's one very powerful idea of why the Western world felt it had to support the local agent. And after all, Israel, is like a mini Western state in the Arab region. So it was like an outpost of empire, to use this old-fashioned phrase. So that was one set of ideas. And indeed, in America, that was a very important factor in considering this unlimited support which the Americans, the American administrations give to the Jewish state. But that wasn't all. If that were all, then you could say, well, all right, let's see if we can get another local agent. Why don't we make friends with the Arabs? Why do you put in an agent which everybody hates in the region, wants to fight, in order to be your local friend? Why don't you make friends with the others and you know, dump the agent? I mean, that would be a perfectly reasonable line of thinking. But you see, there are other things. There is a very powerful, what can I say, a kind of unconscious support, empathy, with the idea of the Jews' return to Zion, the Jewish return to the Holy Land, that the idea that the Holy Land is in essence a Jewish land because of the Bible. And I think if we ignore the influence of the Old Testament and the Bible, then we don't understand Western civilization, because it was very, very important. And although today you will get, for certainly in Europe, many people are not religious and very, very low church attendance and this sort of thing, nevertheless, in the unconscious mind of many Western Europeans, the Old Testament idea is still alive and well. And I only have to point our listeners to the massive evangelical movement in the United States, what we might call the Christian Zionist movement, which is profoundly pro-Israel on religious lines, on a particular reading of the Old Testament, to see how powerful that is as a factor in the continuance of support for the Jewish state. And so, you know, here we go again. If you look at this set of obstacles in the path of Palestinians regaining their rights, it's formidable. It's absolutely formidable.
What about the cost to the Arabs of Israel and the cost to Palestinians and the Arabs? That has never been treated.
No. I'll tell you, one of the reasons that made me write this book was a kind of anger I felt, not just at what had happened to me and my family and the Palestinians and so on, but, you know, it was the anger of the fact that nobody recognized the cost we paid in order to enable the Zionists, the Jews, to the Jewish Zionists to realize their aim of creating a Jewish state. Well, at whose expense was this? You know, it's one thing to say for Western states, for Americans, to say, no, it's only right and proper, the poor Jews, they've suffered so badly, they need a refuge, they need a place of their own. Yeah, it's one thing to say that. But the other question is, at whose expense is all this? Is this at American? Are you in the United States, are you setting aside one of your states in order to make Israel here? Is Germany giving a part of its territory to make Israel there? No. They have decided that we should give up, and we Arabs, not just our territory, but many other things in order to accommodate the Jewish state. Now, the thing that made me angry was that it was unacknowledged. Look, it's one thing to say, look, it's tough, sorry, yeah. We did set it up in your region. Very sorry about what happened to you. What can we do to make amends? We apologize. But it's another to say, well, I'm not even interested. I don't care what it costs you. I don't even know about it. I don't want to know about it. And that made me really very annoyed. So I spent some time and effort setting out the very many ways in which the establishment of Israel damaged the Arab region, and we're not just talking about Palestinians. The cost to Palestinians, I think, is even given pro-Israel bias, is known largely, I would say, that we lost our homeland, that we were made into refugees, that we're not allowed home. I mean, you know, that we suffer under occupation. I think these things are generally known. What is not talked about and not known is that the frontline states, the ones that bordered the new Israel, at the time, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, all these states paid heavily for the establishment of Israel. Not only did they have to play host to the Palestinian refugees, and nobody thinks about that, because after all, the refugee camps are in Arab countries. Now, although the United Nations helped, the Arab countries also paid. They hosted them. They gave territory. They gave citizenship, in the case of Jordan, for example. They gave scholarships. They helped financially, in the case of Syria, and so on. So that was one immediate cost. But of course, as the years went on, there were the wars. We've had 6-7 wars in 60 years since the establishment of Israel, major wars in the Middle East because of Israel. That's a hell of a lot of wars. Now, in addition, the Arabs had to therefore have proper armies. They had to buy arms. So the money they spent on their arms, they couldn't spend on the advancement and the development of their own countries. As a result, Arab education, Arab healthcare, Arab welfare, social reform, etc., had to take a backseat to militarization. And that is only one of the ways in which Israel damaged the Arabs. There are many other ways, things, again, which don't... I mean, these things are obvious, but there are things not so obvious. For example, imagine what it's like for generations of young Arabs born into a world where they knew they had an enemy on their doorstep. Think about it. You know, they didn't come into a world where they could look forward to a normal childhood, adulthood, etc., where they all they had to worry about was their own homes, their education, getting married, whatever. No, no, no. They were told from the moment they opened their eyes, we have a very big enemy which might attack us at any moment. We have to be aware. We have to be ready. This isn't healthy. And hence, you have generations of Arabs reared on hostility, reared on confrontationism, on the knowledge that they could be attacked. And of course, you then had the rise of extreme movements, of Islamic movements, in order to counter this threat from the Jewish state. Now, one could go on and on. I recommend people read my book in order to understand what Israel has meant for the Arabs. And believe you me, once you read about it and understand it, there is no place in the world, in my opinion, which would have been willing to host the state of Israel.
Yes, there is only one right in that area, and that is the Jewish right, which brings to mind one of the comments that Winston Churchill said in an address to the Palestinian Royal Commission in 1937. He said, and I quote, "I do not agree that the dog in a manger has the final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time. I do not admit that right. I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to those people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." What hope is there for the future, short-term or long-term?
Well, I'm afraid that in the short-term there really isn't much hope. It makes me very irritated to hear all this stuff about the peace process, which is a complete sham, and it's a lie, and it's there to deceive people. There is no proper peace process because Israel is too powerful, and the United States wants to continue to allow Israel to be too powerful. That's the truth of it. Now, how are you going to get an agreement when one of the sides is so strong that they can dictate terms and the other side is so weak that they are unable to do anything against the stronger side? You know, by definition, you're not going to get any sort of agreement which is likely to last. And therefore, I'm afraid there is little hope in the short term. And I just really ask that people do understand that they don't derive any sort of comfort. They don't allow themselves to be comforted by all this stuff about people meeting and Condoleezza Rice taking planes and rushing out to the region and President Bush going out next month and all this business, because it's about nothing. It's about nothing. Now, in the longer term, Yes, I do think that there's a solution for this problem. I do, and I think there is only one solution. And it is one that I have discussed towards the end of the book. There is only one solution, and that is to restore the land that is now bitterly divided, cut up, wretched, and a place of tragedy into what it used to be at the time of my birth. A land which was a complete land where Jews and Christians and Muslims lived together, where we had a numerous set of minorities. We had Circassians, we had Armenians, we had Europeans, we had all sorts of people living in Palestine. Everybody was living together. Nobody was saying, this is my place and you get out. People live together. Now, I have a very great hope that people will understand that that is the only way forward for us, that the Jewish Israelis who now inhabit my country should learn to understand that it is not for them alone, and that the inhabitants of that land, the Palestinians, must also live there, and those who were expelled shall return, and they shall live together with the community that already lives there, and work out a means, a political system, whereby there is equality, there is democracy, and there is a situation where people build together, they cooperate, they do not fight, they do not aim to grab each other's bit of land or water or whatever it may be. That is the so-called one-state solution, and it's the solution that I believe is the only one we should look to. And you know, I have to tell you, whenever I mention this, many Jewish people immediately start shouting and saying, you want to destroy us, you want to kill Jews, this sort of thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. And really, you know, if you think about it, it is astonishing that a solution so humane, so just, so fair, so optimistic, should be dismissed as if it were either a recipe for the destruction of the Israeli Jewish people, or that it is utopian and completely out of reach. It's not out of reach. All we have to do is make it happen.
Thank you, Dr. Karmi. I wish we could continue our discussion for hours. I could continue this interview again for a long time, but we have run out of time. So thank you very much for being our guest today.
And thank you for hosting me.
It was a great privilege and pleasure to have you with us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the distinguished Palestinian physician and scholar, Dr. Hada Karmi, research fellow and lecturer at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom, and world-renowned author and commentator on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As we have said before several times on this program, we continue to believe that if the Israelis and Palestinians were allowed to mix freely, they would in time be able to resolve their differences themselves on their own, and the need for conflict would evaporate. What keeps them apart are the ideologies of the leaders on one side, the Zionist ideology of conquest, and the greed of the leadership on the other side, which exploits this conflict to accumulate personal wealth and influence. Last week, in a report by Democracy Now!, we learned that the Israeli police raided a television station in Bethlehem, whose mission it is to get Palestinians and Israelis to mix freely, which is an indication of how the Zionist leadership in Israel fears the idea of having their people mix with Palestinians and resolve any differences they might have before the Zionist dream of conquest is realized. And that is all we have for today. This is Sharif Fahm signing off for This Week in Palestine and reminding our listeners to get involved in the good fight. Get involved. Thank you.